If I don't say any of that, remind me. So, Ollie's coming from the side.
Sorry?
My ear's completely blocked.
Oh, sorry. Just to go back home, if that helps you. I sit down.
Which one?
Just here.
Okay.
Sit down. It's okay. Right.
Okay.
It's a little bit after 11:10, although people are still pouring in, so let's get started. Maybe I will turn on my mic. Okay, can people hear me now? Okay, let's see. I'll begin with a couple of announcements of events. Nobody came to me and said, there's a march on Parliament to demand better funding for universities, partly because Nick Clegg is there, and it's leaving Bristow Square at 11:30, so I might leave your lecture at 11:30. I hope you don't mind. Nobody came up to say that to me. But if you did want to leave, I wouldn't mind if you waited till noon and then went, I wouldn't mind that either. And of course, I know nothing, right? I'm just a professor. I am prejudiced in favor of education. You might have different prejudices, so I'm not telling you to go. I just wanted you to be aware of it in case you were interested. I'm sure the people downstairs can tell you much more about those events. What somebody did come and do very helpfully before the lecture today is I mentioned yesterday that there are these Hamming lectures inspired by this comment of Hamming as to, well, why aren't you working on the important problems? It's being given by Steve Reynolds, who works on speech understanding. He does things like put lots of microphones in a conference room and then try to actually make sense of the conference so it can be automatically indexed and you can look at it later. So if you want to hear him explain why that's an important problem, I think you might agree that it is, he will be speaking tomorrow at 4 o'clock? 4 o'clock. Thank you. 4 o'clock across the street in the Informatics Forum in room 431/433. And everybody who's a member of the university is very welcome to attend. We do all the teaching over here and all the research across the street for VAT purposes, but that talk counts as research, and you're all very welcome to attend a research talk, so please feel free. So I promised we'd be giving out awards today for the competition. It's a bit sad. Last year we had 16 entries, this year we have 4 entries. I'm not sure why there's been such a change. We have had a decline in people enrolling. Last year we had more people enrolled than we could deal with comfortably. But anyhow, we haven't had a fourfold decline, but we've had a fourfold decline in entries for the competition. But we've had 4 nice entries, and each of them gets an award. What we've done this year is, as last year, the first place award is a book token for £20, second place is £10, third place is £5, and fourth place is £2.50. So, isn't that a lovely manger scene? With an L system to provide a wreath. So, oops, I need to click on back. So that is fourth place, and that goes to Jose Emilio Munoz Lopez. You should come down so I can hand you a book token.
Thank you very much.
Here you go. Well done. That's a little hard to come out on the screen. No, you can't see that. So there's some nice little pictures, but what's really particularly cool about this entry, oh, open with save file. Let's do save file. Let's see if I can get this to open. Yes. Yes, I want to open the file. Windows cannot open the file. Oh, dear. All right. Windows is unhappy with me. We will give up. Go away. So I can't show you the code. Sorry. I should have tested. Well, it's hard to test on this machine. Yeah, I could muck around for quite a while and finally get it to open, but I'm not going to. Instead, I will just describe it to you and point out that if you do look at the code, which you're welcome to do online, you will see that each of these wee pictures has been described by a string with new lines in it, with different characters corresponding to the different shapes, and that's translated into appropriate commands to a turtle in the language that you were given. So it's a nice little program for drawing different pictures, making use of this clever idea of using ASCII strings to specify what you've done. So that's third place, and that's Clemens Wolf. I think you deserve an extra award for getting out of your seat so quickly. Well done. Now, for third place, I'm going to change the source of one of these. So that is a very retro game of Pong, but it's written in Haskell using functional reactive programming and arrows. So Jacob Essex wins second place. Well done. And then finally, no prizes for guessing what's left. George Koloff wrote this lovely program, which what it does is it first draws out an L system and then draws it again and again and again so that you get this little layered picture with this three-dimensional effect. We did test out you could use any L system and put it in and get this three-dimensional picture. So for that bit of clever, oh, and he also came up with an L system which signs his signature, Koshov. So for that bit of cleverness, would Georgi Koshov please come up for first place? Well done. Any questions about that? So I think we should have a final round of applause for all of our winners, because they all did a great job. You know what? If I type Control L on your laptop, it doesn't affect what appears on that screen.
Should it?
No. No, it shouldn't at all. It was very stupid of me to think it would. Do you want this back now?
No, it's fine.
Okay, we'll just leave that back. Right. So the subject of today's lecture is you're finally going to learn why Haskell is called Haskell. And it also involves pretty much the coolest idea I know. Literally, I would like to write an epic poem about this idea. I want to write a book for the public describing this idea, and how can get the book, public to read a book about science? I figure I will try to write it in the same kind of quatrains used by Pushkin in his epic poem, Eugene Onegin. So that's my goal in life. So you're going to hear it not as an epic poem. But this is the talk for which I wear my lambda tie, so I'm wearing it now. So let's begin. Boolean algebra, right? You've all been spending your computation and logic learning about Boolean algebra. There he is, George Boole, who lived from 1815 to 1864, and among other things wrote this book, which you can still get in the bookstore, The Laws of Thought. That was how he described Boolean algebra. Remember we were talking yesterday about selling your work? You can see he was doing that. And is that? Yeah. Logic has been around not just since 1847, but since the ancient Greeks. In the Middle Ages, the scholars tried to systematize the rules for inference given by the ancient Greeks, going back to Aristotle. And they came up with rules such as things would be written in certain forms. So the ancient, the medieval scholars and the ancient Greeks talked about forms such as every x is a y. No x is a y. Some x is a y. Some x is not a y. And due to all the work done in logic, some of which we're going to review now, by Boole and those who followed him, you now know how to encode these very systematically, right, using universal quantifiers and existential quantifiers. Now, Boole didn't know about quantifiers, but he knew enough to come up with and or as operators of the logic, and not, and he wrote and as multiplication, and not as subtraction. So if false is 0 and true is 1, then 1 minus y would be not y, right? Because 1 minus whatever takes 0 into 1 and 1 into 0. So it's negation. So you could say every x is a y by saying x is true and not y is true. Why does that tell us that every x is a y? Oh, sorry. X and not y is false. That makes more sense. Right? Which, if you work it out, is equivalent to saying not x or y, which is exactly the definition you used, you learned of x implies y. So if x implies y, everything satisfying property x also satisfies property y. And similarly for the others. And then he had things like this proposition. That axiom of metaphysicians, which is termed the principle of contradiction, and which affirms that it is impossible for any being to possess a quality, and at the same time not to possess it, is a consequence of the fundamental law of thought, whose expression is x squared equals x. You might not have thought of that as a fundamental law of thought, but what was he getting at? Well, x squared equals x is satisfied by exactly two numbers, 0 and 1. And then he did this bit of reasoning. Well, if x squared is equal to x, then x minus x squared is equal to 0. So x times 1 minus x is equal to 0. So x and not x is false, which is the law of contradiction. Very clever bit of reasoning. If you tried to do this in Boolean algebra, you would discover that Boole was using reasoning in something other than Boolean algebra. This is not a valid inference in Boolean algebra. You actually have to start with x and not x or something similar as a hypothesis. It doesn't follow from the other things. Of course, x squared equals x is like saying x and x is x, which is the idempotent law for the and operator. So that is something which is valid in Boolean algebra. But this bit of reasoning going, in particular going from this to this using subtraction, doesn't work. Okay, so that's Boole. And he got things rolling by noticing connections between logic and algebra. Why did it take so long until the middle 1850s to notice these connections? This is not entirely clear, right? Logic had been around for an awful long time. But you couldn't actually have recognized the relationship too much earlier because algebra hadn't been around for that long. Algebra was more recent. Okay, so after Boole, we have Frege. Here's Gottlob Frege. He lived from 1848 to 1925. And he came up with something called the Begriffsschrift, which was a way of writing down logic. So the way he writes A, the way he would write B implies A is one of these diagrams with a B off on a hook. So he was actually writing down parse trees for expressions. He actually used a tree-like form to write things out rather than writing out as a sequence of symbols. So he already understood about parsing and trees. So this is his way of writing B implies A, and this is his way of writing B. And this downward stroke he called the truth stroke. So if you didn't have that stroke there, you would just be saying, consider the idea that B implies A. But if you write this stroke next to it, that stroke means I am asserting it is true that that B implies A. And that stroke has survived to this day. When you were studying logic, you saw that symbol, sometimes pronounced turnstile. Right? You remember seeing that in logic? That is derived from this truth stroke. So what he's written here is, it is true that B implies A, and it is true that B, and from that, of course, you can conclude A, an idea that by the ancient scholars was called modus ponens. If you know B and you know B implies A, then of course you can conclude A. Okay, and in modern terminology, we would write it like this. B implies A, and B, and from these two things, you can conclude A. You've seen things like this in computation and logic, right? And he then introduced the notion of quantifier. It was also introduced by a mathematician called Peirce at about the same time. And he says, well, look, if we know that A implies phi of little a, and little a doesn't appear anywhere in big A, then this reasoning is going to be true no matter what little a is. So we can say that A implies for all little a, phi of A. So that little dip with the variable written in it was his way of saying for all. So in modern terms, you'd write it this way. If A implies phi of little a, then you can conclude, and there's a side condition, little a doesn't appear in big A, then you can conclude that A implies for all a, phi of little a. It got a little bit more complicated. He would write very complicated trees. And what he was building up to was writing down a definition of natural numbers, how to count. Now, this seems to me sort of weird, because natural numbers seem to me completely obvious, and this doesn't seem to me obvious at all. So using this as a way of natural numbers appears to me to be backwards. But that was the origin. He really, really, really wanted to understand what natural numbers were. And so he invented logic as a way of explaining them. And he understood that there were deep connections and that logic might also be used to explain a lot of how language is used. And for instance, if you go to the Hamming lecture tomorrow, you'll see a lot about how that has developed. Now, Frege had a certain number of axioms that he assumed, and from those you could derive all the theorems. So his axioms were the law of modus ponens, and then these three things, which don't look all that natural. Okay, this says it, A implies that B implies A, for any propositions A and B. Of course, that's true, because A implies A. So if you know A, and then you know some other B, you still know A. And this is a little bit more complicated. If C implies B implies A, then C implies B implies C implies A. And this one is, C implies B implies A implies B implies C implies A. Later on, it was learned that, in fact, this third one, in fact, follows from the other two. But that was not completely obvious. But you can actually prove the third one from the other two. So what was left to do? Well, now notice, by the way, I want you to notice the time scale of these things. Right? Boole wrote Laws of Thought. He wrote his first book, I think, in, right, The Mathematical Analysis of Logic in 1847, and then The Laws of Thought a few years later, which refined the ideas. The Begriffsschrift was written in 1879, so a gap of about 30 years. Here's Gerhard Gentzen, who lived from 1909 to 1945. And in 1934, so about 50 years later, he came out with what is the formulation of logic that you learn in computation and logic today. And it's the standard textbook formulation, natural deduction. So here are the rules as written in Frege's original paper. And they look exactly like the rules we use today, down to writing and for and a V for or, and an upside down A for all, and an upside down E for there exists. By the way, this was the first paper in which you would find all these bits of notation. Various bits were introduced before, but Frege, for instance, upside down E existed before, That was in Russell and Whitehead's Principia Mathematica. So there's a lot of work going on in logic in this time, right? I'm just hitting some of the highlights. Russell and Whitehead did Principia Mathematica in 1910, I think. Hilbert was doing a lot looking at logic during this time period. So there were other giants looking at these things. But Gentzen was the one who really took all the work Frege did and put it in a solid form. And Gentzen, by the way, was the one who introduced using an upside-down A for all. So this is exactly the way we do it now, except he wrote his letters in German, and we don't. Right, so you've got this fancy Germanic A and B. Here's, I didn't write all the rules out in modern form, but here's some of the most important rules. This says if you can prove A and you can prove B, then you can prove A and B. Right, you've seen this rule, right? And if you can prove A and B, you can conclude A. Have you seen that rule? And if you can prove A and B, of course, you can conclude B. Pretty straightforward. Notice these rules come in beautiful pairs. This rule has an A and B above the line, sorry, below the line, and bits of it above. This rule has A and B above the line and bits of it below. So this constructs a conjunction. This decomposes a conjunction. And it was Gentzen's brilliant insight that the rules should come in pairs. One to compose, one to decompose. Similarly, this one says, if you assume A, and you from that assumption you can prove B, then you know A implies B. And what we've done here is we've marked the assumption with a little letter, and then we've marked the inference rule with a letter, so we can tell which assumption is being used by which inference rule to introduce an implication. And then the other rule is familiar modus ponens. If you know A implies B, and you know A, you can conclude B. Just like before, but we've reversed the roles of B and A. Okay. Any questions about those? Are those rules familiar? Please nod your head, or else I'll have to explain them. Okay. So here's a proof. Here's the proof that B and A implies A and B. You'd obviously want that to be true. How would you prove it? Well, let's assume B and A. And from the assumption B and A, of course, we can conclude A. From the assumption B and A, we can conclude B. We've proved A and B, so we can conclude A and B. And now we discharge our assumption, and we know that B and A implies A and B. We've seen proofs like that before, right? Maybe not of something quite so trivial. Well, we can also simplify proofs. Now, this was something that Gentzen wanted to do, but Gentzen couldn't actually see how to do it. So he invented a second whole system of logic, the sequent calculus, because he could work out how to simplify proofs in sequent calculus and not in natural deduction. Another 20 years later, Prawitz figured out how to simplify proofs in natural deduction. So this is Prawitz's work. So you can simplify a proof. Right? Let's say, I'm just going to show it to you in the proof. So here's a proof. It's a silly proof that of A and B. Okay, so here is the proof we did before that B and A implies A and B. And here I've assumed B and I've assumed A, and from assuming B and assuming A, I can prove B and A. And then by modus ponens, since B and A implies A and B, I know A and B from my proof of B and A. But that was stupid, right? Question. What did the superscripts Z and X and Y represent? Remember I said we would label each assumption with a letter, and then when that assumption is discharged, that is, right, what this rule here says, notice the little super Z there. It says, look, you have two assumptions called Z of B and A. Instead of assuming B and A and proving A and B, we will just say that from B and A, that B and A implies A and B. So that's called discharging the assumption. It's an instance of this rule, whoops, there. It's an instance of this rule I was showing you here. So when we remove the assumption and instead add an implication, we call that discharging the assumption. And we label the assumption with a letter so we can tell which one we're talking about. Okay? Good question. And you notice these are both labeled with letters that don't appear anywhere else because we don't discharge these assumptions. Okay. Now, we'd like to just do a straightforward proof, right? From the assumption B and the assumption A, I can conclude A and B directly. How do I get there? Well, what I can do is take, instead of assuming B and A and using it to prove A and B, look, here I've got a proof of B and A. So instead of assuming it, I will just substitute the proof for the assumption. So we're replacing the assumption by a proof that that fact is true. So now I've just copied this proof twice, once to here and once to here. So I've used the simplification rule. And now I've got from B and A, assume B and A, and then from B and A, conclude A. Well, that's silly. Why don't I just copy this proof, which in this case the proof is very simple, just an assumption, down to here. I don't need to go through B and A. I can simplify this one similarly. And now I've got from A and B, directly I can conclude A and B, which is the straightforward proof. So let me show you the two rules we were using. Right? The first rule says, if from the assumption A you can prove B, well, that gives you A implies B. And somewhere else you have a proof of A, well, you can conclude B. Let's simplify that. Just replace every occurrence of the assumption by the proof. Similarly, this rule says, well, if you've got proof of A and a proof of B, you can use those to prove A and B. From a proof from A and B, you can, of course, conclude A. But that's really silly and long-winded. Let's just use the proof of A directly. So this one does some substitution, and this one just removes some useless junk. So here we were doing the substitution, and here we were using the remove useless junk rule twice. We've simplified down to the proof we wanted. Now, proof simplification, I think, is not something you saw in computation and logic. Is that right? But there's a good reason for talking about it now. You'll see what it is in a minute. So now, at last, we get to lambda. So the lambda calculus was invented by Alonzo Church, who lived from 1903 to 1995. And this was not 50 years after Gentzen invented natural deduction. It was at the same time. So in 1932, Church published the first paper on lambda calculus. And there it is. That is it, the first lambda. And Church was a logician. He was trying to understand the nature of functions, which was something that other people like Gentzen and Frege had looked at earlier. Sorry, not Gentzen, but Frege had looked at earlier. So you remember when I talked about currying, I mentioned that, in fact, Frege had already had this idea that you could express a function of two arguments as a function of one argument that itself returned a function of one argument. And Church exploited that. So he only needed functions of one argument, which he wrote lambda x m, where m was a formula that contained x as a free variable. And then he had some reduction rules, the most important one being this substitution rule. Lambda x u says that, so an example of a rule like this is lambda x, x times x for the squaring function. An example of a term t might be 3, and what he says is, okay, you would replace, to evaluate the function, you would replace x in this expression by 3. So in u, take t and use that to replace x. So this notation here just stands for substitution. So now here we would have lambda x, x times x applied to 3, and here we would just replace x by 3, so we'd have 3 times 3. You've seen the stupid computer do this lots and lots of times. So Church had names for his rules. There was a rule saying what you use as the free variable doesn't matter. I didn't copy that rule down here. Maybe I should have. So it says that lambda xu is the same as lambda yu with y replacing x. Another substitution. And that just says you can change the names of the free variables, as long as you're consistent, it doesn't matter. Another rule that you've seen used at length in this class. So that rule, the first, the one for renaming, is called the alpha rule. It was his first rule. And this rule, the one for substituting a actual for a formal parameter, is called the beta reduction rule. So you've been doing beta reduction all term, you just didn't know it was called beta reduction. And then these other rules he didn't actually need, because he could define pairs constructing a pair and selecting out the first or second element of a pair in terms of lambdas. But we're going to skip over that and many other later lambda calculi, just like Haskell, right? Have a rule saying you can build pairs, and then the first function extracts the first component of the pair, and the second function extracts the second component of the pair. So we're going to make use of that. Right. And then the stupid computer can simplify terms. It can, yes. Right. So if you've got lambda z, second of z, paired with first of z, applied to y and x, we'll just substitute y and x for z. And then we've got second of y and x and first of y of x. And the second of y and x is x. And the first of y and x is y. So we just get x paired with y. That was easy. Now, I mentioned the church did that basic idea of alpha and beta reduction in 1932. He actually wanted to use this as a way of writing down logical formula. And it was a very powerful way of writing down logical formula. It was so powerful that he could write down a formula that could prove false. In fact, sorry. No, he could write down a proof of false using a particular formula. So just from the fact that he could write down this particular formula, he could write a proof of false. From false, you can imply anything else. So he could prove anything. It was an inconsistent logic. So to make the logic consistent, he added types, which ruled out this particular strange kind of formula. So he added types to his terms. And what we write as a function arrow, I'm going to write here as an implication. And what we write as the pair type in parentheses, I'm going to write as an ampersand. But he meant the same thing. And he used slightly different notations for these. But I'm using this notation for a reason that will become clear. So this says, well, let x be a free variable of type A. And let u be a term containing x, which has type b. And of course, lambda x u is a term that's a function from an argument of type a to a result of type b. And if s is a function from a to b, and t has type a, then of course, s applied to t has type b. So this should be familiar to you from using Haskell. I'm just writing the function arrow in this funny way. Similarly, if T is a term of type A and U is a term of type B, then a T-U pair is an A-B pair. So we would write that open parenthesis A comma B close parenthesis. Here I'm just writing it A and B. And similarly, if S is a term, is an A-B pair, of course, first of S has type A and second of S has type B. So it's an unfamiliar notation, but the ideas are very familiar from Haskell, right? So, one thing that we want to know is if we start with a program and simplify it the way this stupid computer does, if the program has a type, as we simplify, those simplified steps should have the same type. And that way we know that a program whose type is integer always returns a simple value, an actual number that is an integer. This is called type safety. Right? It's the most obvious thing you want to know about type system, that as you simplify your program, as you perform your reduction steps, the terms you get still have the same type. So let's check that that is true. Here's a program. Z has type B and A. So second of Z has type A. First of Z has type B. A pair of a second of Z and a first of Z has type A and B, and lambda z, second of z, first of z, is a function then that takes a BA pair to an AB pair just by reversing the components. Does anything look familiar yet? What happens if I just put on special colored, rose-colored glasses that remove everything red and only let me see the blue? What are we left with? Right, we're left with the proof we had before that B and A implies A and B. So these lambda terms actually encode proofs. And there's more. Right? It's the usual thing where I'm selling you knives. There's more. Simplifying a program, so here's the more complicated proof, right? And the more complicated proof says, right, we're going to build a YX pair, and we're going to, where Y and X are the proofs of B and A, respectively. And I'm going to apply this function to them, right? And of course, if you apply this function to YX pair, you get an XY pair. Right? And how do we apply the function? Right? We just substitute. We take YX and we use it to replace the free variable Z. Well, notice when we do that, in this proof that the program has a certain type, we've replaced the assumption that Z is a variable of type B and A by this term YX and a proof that YX has type B and A. So we replace our assumption that Z has a given type by a proof that it has that type, that the thing we substituted for Z has that type. And now again, we have introduced a step where we're building up a pair and then decomposing the pair, and we can simplify that. So instead of building up a YX pair and then extracting the second component of it, here, I can just simplify that to extract that component directly and just take X as the second thing in the pair, and similarly here. And that's just the stupid computer saying, well, second of Y and X is X. So this proof principle that says, well, if from assumptions B and A, you can prove B and A, and then from that you can conclude A, well, you might as well just prove A directly. That just says if you can build up a pair and then extract the second component, well, just use the second component directly. So, every proof corresponds to a term in lambda calculus, which is a program. And simplifying a proof is just like running that program, reducing that program. So there's a relationship like this between proofs and programs. And the name of that relationship is the Curry-Howard isomorphism. This is sort of a picture of it called the using topology, done by a colleague of mine. So the isomorphism says, well, look, implies in logic is just like function time. And in logic is just like pairing, which is often written as times. Because remember I showed you about arithmetic in logic? With types, and that indeed forming pairs was a lot like times, and the either type with left and right components was a lot like sums and is a lot like or. So there's Curry, there's Howard. Howard hasn't died yet, so I've not been able to look up on Wikipedia when he was born. They only put in your dates when you die, or at least last time I looked. Maybe they've added it by now. Last time I looked, I couldn't find when he was born because he hadn't died yet. So this is Haskell Curry, who first wrote down a correspondence between logic and functions. And later, William Howard rewrote that in this paper, which was, by the way, a festschrift for Curry, a book devoted to Curry on the occasion of his, as it says here, dedicated to H.B. Curry. On the occasion of his 80th birthday. Every single paper in this book has that dedication. And in it, he said, right, here's our formulation of logic. There it is written out neatly, very much the way you and I saw it a moment ago. Here's our formulation of lambda calculus. And he made the same observation that we just did, that these are in precise one-to-one correspondence. And then he went on from that saying, well, if and or correspond to very useful operations in lambda calculus, what would for all correspond to? What would there exist correspond to? And he came up with much more complicated type systems, which are called dependent type systems, and are the basis now for systems such as Koch and Isabel and Agde that are used to write down proofs. So the standard technique now used to write down proofs is as lambda terms. And people want to write down proofs because they want to do things like prove that a particular program satisfies a certain property. And they do this about things like airplanes, where you really want to make sure that the software in the airplane doesn't malfunction. Or for train systems, for switching systems for trains. And it's standard now to write down these large complicated proofs using lambda terms. So let's talk about aliens, shall we? We have tried to communicate with aliens, right? This is a plaque that was put on the Voyager spacecraft, and it shows a picture of the Voyager spacecraft, and then these two pictures of people next to it, so that you can see how big people are relative to the Voyager spacecraft. And then this is trying to locate the Earth. So this is a sketch of what our solar system looks like with all the planets and the path that Voyager took out of the solar system. This is a picture of a helium atom. These are different quasars, and the distance of this line corresponds to the distance of that quasar from our sun. And you can't see this very easily, but you might see that there are little marks along those lines, and that's writing out in binary, in ones and zeros, the frequency of that quasar in terms of the hydrogen frequency. That's why there's a hydrogen atom here. So what would aliens understand of this? Right? It depends. Right? If Star Trek is correct, they will look at these people and they'll go, they're just like us, except they don't have pubic hair. If Star Trek is not right, right, they might look at them and go, mmm, tasty. Oh, look, and this is how we get to them. Or they might not understand these pictures at all, right? Maybe they don't have a visual system. Maybe they'll just be feeling this thing tactily, and they'll work out, oh, this is Braille, these are distances, this is where their planet is, this weird thing, I have no idea what it is. Maybe it's a representation of them. Maybe it's a recipe for something that they like. Maybe it's a song, but we don't have ears either. Right? So they might not understand this bit, but they will probably be able to work out this bit. Now, here's another use of aliens in the film Independence Day. This film came out in 1996. So it was. It included things like blowing up the White House, as you can see here, and the Empire State Building. This was back when blowing up large buildings was fantasy. And the way they destroy the aliens is with a computer program. So here's a screenshot I took of this computer program. You can tell it's a virus because it has a skull and crossbones next to it. And if you look, you can see it's written with lots of curly brackets. So when I first saw this film, I was working at Bell Labs. Ken Thompson, who designed the C programming language, was in the office down the hall from mine. I thought, wow, that's cool. Somebody down the hall from me did something that appeared in a popular film, because I assumed this was the C programming language. Little did I know that there's this other programming language called Java, and it was probably actually written in Java. But probably not. I think that was before Java spread throughout the known universe. So would this work? Could you give aliens a computer virus written in C or in Java? What alien would know Java or C? It just doesn't make any sense. Right? They would probably have as much trouble decoding Java or C as they have decoding this bit of the picture. Except, right, evolution might lead to creatures that have two arms and two legs. Right? There's some reason to believe that evolution could possibly often lead in that direction, although certainly not always. And possibly not, right? Possibly evolution will lead to lots stranger things. For the same reason, you know, it's highly unlikely that just at random some alien race would come up with C or Java. But not Haskell. We have just discovered that, of course, aliens will know Haskell. Well, maybe not Haskell as you and I know it. Right? They might write it down in a completely different way. Many of the strange ideas in Haskell, like monads or type classes, maybe they won't have that. But the lambda calculus? Yes, they will know lambda calculus. They will have to know lambda calculus, right? If they know logic, they must know lambda calculus, because the two fit like this. So what I would like to do is to say, throughout the universe, every living